Insights, and I am coming to you live. We are doing another live pop-up stream here. I've been doing quite a few of these on the Nimshi channel, and it's been a lot of fun. And I've actually got my first victim today, Jonathan Otis, who runs mergers and acquisitions for us here at Nimshi Insights, and we're going to be talking about some of the reasons why companies are bought and sold in the language services industry. And some of the answers, some of the stories that you're going to hear might surprise you, because they surprised me the first time. Just a quick shout out, a round of housekeeping before we get started, before I introduce J.O. If you're not already, make sure to subscribe to Nimshi, like, share, comment, whatever platform that we're on. We're coming to you live on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter today. So make sure to spread the love. Tag your friends. Bring people into the conversation. Also, if you have any questions or comments or disagreements, I love disagreements. I know J.O. loves disagreements. Make sure to leave those in the comments, and we will be bringing those up on screen here, giving you a shout out if you participate in the comments. So make sure to do that. So without further ado, I would like to introduce my colleague, Jonathan Otis, or as we call him, J.O. Tell us a little bit about yourself, J.O., and what you do at Nimshi.
So thank you, Tucker. Hello, everybody. I run the M&A practice here at Nimshi. I've been doing that for 2 years now, and we've had a lot of fun and a lot of success. I'm new to the language space for the last 2 years, but I think I've brought my own unique perspective to it. And in some respects, it's very similar to other industries. I come from the tech world, and there's a huge amount of technology affecting the language services space. And that's been all over some of the M&A deals that we've been doing.
And so what is that? What is that like coming into the industry from outside of the industry? What are some of the things that you had to learn? And what are some of the things that you're glad that you didn't know coming into this industry?
Well, I didn't know a lot about it. I certainly didn't know how large it was, how it affects and touches basically everything going on in the economy. How the services are used by companies that want to grow, and how, you know, communications doesn't happen, you know, without language. And, you know, communications between people is just huge. And so I didn't realize it was quite as large and big a deal as it was. It's not something that you feel, that everyday people feel per se, which is maybe something that's shows the success of the industry, is that it's happening behind the scenes and making all this happening, and people really don't feel the amount of work it really takes to do that. But be it as it may, I'm very impressed with it. I'm enjoying it greatly. I'm enjoying the people, meeting the people that are in the industry, and I look forward to doing a lot more.
Yeah, it really is about people, this industry. That's one thing I think that we can certainly all agree on. Without further ado, let's get right into it here, because we wanted to talk today about reasons why localization industries are bought and sold in this. And, you know, I certainly have some comments here, some ideas, but I thought it would be interesting to start us off before we get into this conversation, just to frame the conversation a little bit. You actually recorded a video about over a year ago, because I think we did it during our All Hands when we all got together here in Seattle. And I just thought I'd share that with our audience here today. If anybody's out there watching, give me one moment and cue the video.
Hi, I'm Jonathan. I work M&A here at Nimshi. The market landscape for acquisitions and mergers has been very strong for many, many years. And it continues. I see technology being probably the number one reason people are acquiring companies. I see companies buying others for customers, for revenue, for vertical speciality. I see people buying companies for the people. Always important to get really good people. Most people think they know everything there is to know about mergers and acquisition. The one thing I tell most people,
by the way, I love that little halfway through, like, oh, thank God that scene's over.
If you're selling your company,
I can't hear or see anything. So
you can't hear or see anything. Sorry.
Value. No, it's their job. That's all right. I am your guinea pig.
Markets knowing that you're available, It's their job to actually find value inside your organization you might not realize you have. It's their job to match you up with people, both people that are natural partners and people that are not natural partners. And I think we do that better than most because we have such a strong set of experience inside the industry. We have knowledge about all the different players. We have people from outside the industry who work for NIMSY who are bringing in different perspectives. And we just have a view of making the right connection, just not a quick connection. It's not always about the money, it's really about the business. And I think NIMSY's important.
All right, now you're getting into your sales pitch on the YouTube video. But the video was essentially, you know, going back, I'm gonna bring up the slides here. The video was essentially about talking about this concept of why companies are bought and sold. And I want to just turn it over to you and let you riff on this a little bit, because there are all sorts of different reasons, from technology, people, clients, revenue, vertical speciality. These are the ones that you mentioned a year ago, but perhaps you have some more in the last year that you've come across. So let's talk about it.
Happy to. So I think we talked about the high level reasons, and you know, but every deal is its own. It's very subjective to buy and sell a company. There's no real, nothing is the same between any two deals. And everyone is very particular to the buyers and the sellers. And I think maybe one adage to start with is, you know, why people don't sell their companies. Just to add a little twist to it before we really get into it. I do talk to a lot of people, and lots of times we'll agree that it's not the right time to buy something. Or to sell something, I should say. And so those reasons include that perhaps their company is simply making more money than their money that they would make in interest or in other investments. So they're making more money than the market's making, which is actually very easy to do in the language services space. Another one was really into a lifestyle of lighting, enjoying doing donations and giving a lot back to society and the community that they're in. And they felt that if they didn't have their company underneath them, that they wouldn't be able to do as much of that. So they really didn't want to sell their company because they just felt that their place in the community was a big part of owning it. So there's lots of reasons why people don't sell too. And, you know, part of working with our customers is understanding that side of it. On the other side, I think that, you know, big companies buy for two or three reasons that I talked about in my video and I'll mention again. You know, they're looking for revenue. There's only 1,000 Fortune 1000s. There's lots of language service providers fighting over the same customers. So acquisition is really the best and easiest way to add customers and both add more of the same type of customers and add different kinds of customers in new verticals and other things. Acquisitions is about getting technology. You might want to certain things in your workflow. You might want to have certain tools in the media and gaming spaces. You might have done your own MT integrations. And so technology is a big deal there. And technology is affecting the industry greatly. There's all the pressures of MT coming from one side. There's all the pressures of lowering costs from customers who want more languages and would like their cost per word to come down as they increase the number of languages and other things like that. And then, of course, there's people. It's very hard to find good people. It takes time. And sometimes it's easier to just find the right person and buy the company that they're in versus trying to get them. Or if you want a whole group of people, a development group, a low cost processing center in another country, the easiest thing would be to buy an LSP in that country. So there's just lots of different reasons. And these are fairly well known to people. They shouldn't be really crazy. They're not crazy ideas, but they really float to the top is what's really driving everything. And today with the economy, what's happening with the pandemic, I think the customer acquisition desire is driving most of, if not all the acquisitions that are taking place right now.
Wow. a lot to digest there. Yeah. What would you recommend for, so let's say, That's a lot of information. And full disclosure for those that are watching, Tucker Johnson, I'm not very involved in the M&A side of what we do. That's all JO. So I am playing the role of audience surrogate here, asking stupid questions so that you don't have to today. Say I'm a company owner. I am a company owner. And say I want to find out how much my company is worth. Just because that's the first step, right? That's the first step, to have a number in my mind, how much I want to sell for, and then figure out if I can achieve that. Where do I go? Where do I turn? Are there resources out there?
Well, there's a lot of people that will, there's a lot of ways to assign value to an organization. And in the language services space, there's two metrics that are primary. One is simply what's your revenue, and then what's your profit. And profit happens at different levels. There's gross profit, there's net profit. We turn the net profit number into the EBITDA number. And then we have something we call the adjusted EBITDA, which is adding back all the items that are not important to the day-to-day operations. So that's really the operating value of a company can be determined by the seller and the acquirer. I like to first look at just revenue itself. Your general revenue level will determine kind of the multiple that you'll get. Okay. And I like to start with like 1x revenue. You know, if you're a $3 million company and you're doing $3 million a year, you know, we can kind of look and see, are you worth more than $3 million? Are you worth $3 million? Are you worth less than $3 million? And there's certain ways to look at that, looking at gross profit and other things. When we get down to the EBITDA number, you know, financial people like to look at the EBITDA number because they look at multiples of that as being the real value. The EBITDA multiple that might be applied to you will vary depending on the size of the EBITDA as compared to revenue. Are you making 10% of your revenue bottom line? Are you making 20%? Are you making 30%? Are you making 40%? As that number grows, the EBITDA multiple will grow. And the EBITDA multiples also will grow based on the size of the total revenue. So people will pay more for a company that's $15 million per year revenue than they'll pay for a company that's $5 million per year revenue on a multiple basis. So we work with people on that. We're happy to consult and give you a high level view of what we think you might be worth. And we always do that, you know, as we enter into an agreement to sell somebody so that we have expectations, because you really have to have a common expectation to be successful. It's not great to come to the market and say, well, we want to sell, and don't have a number or don't really know what you would say yes to. And we spend a lot of time working with our customers to make sure that, you know, we're all in agreement on what a valuation might look like, who would be interested in paying that. And today there's different multiples based on whether you're a services company or a technology company. And most LSPs are a blend of the two. And, you know, that's good and that's bad. We're seeing a lot of different things happening on the multiple level based on that. And the pandemic, as I said, is driving people to want to do acquisitions to get more revenue. And I think the multiples have come up in the last year a little bit because there's basically more buyers than sellers. And the language space has done very well through the pandemic. People want to take advantage of that going forward.
Mentioned technology, a mix of technology and services. Talk to me a little bit about that. Like, if I'm an LSP owner, is technology my friend? Should I be investing in technology to improve my valuation for when I eventually want to sell? Should I be building my own technology?
Well, I think you talked about two things there. Should you be investing in technology? Yes. Should you be building your own? Maybe.
Touché.
So I would say that there's a lot of technology available in the market. There's a lot of companies who just write the software that drives the workflows and aren't really in the services business. LSPs, I think, are looking at these all the time, and they're using these, and everybody should. You should be using best of breed products, and you should be using products from different vendors that work together. We call that open systems. So you want to be using open products that work together, so that today you might be using a fantastic TMS and all of a sudden a better QA tool comes out how easily will that QA tool fit into your workflow? And so you always need to be looking at that. Should you be developing your own software? At a high level, I would say if you're a smaller organization, probably not. But where you would be investing your own is if you really felt that you needed something super special for the types of customers you have, that you need something to really differentiate you in the marketplace. That's always a way for technology. And then technology should be driving your costs down. So if your gross profit's not at the right level, or if you want to go after a certain kind of business that requires a different workflow that you can't find publicly, or if you need to drive a workflow in a certain way to lower your costs and drive your gross profit up, absolutely you should invest in that. But you should be doing that very carefully and not over investing, because your return on that, getting money back for that investment, could be difficult. It's not easy to sell technology these days because there's so much of it out there. And there's so much open source out there that you need to, if you're investing, it should really be something that's super, super differentiated. And that's hard to do in a mature market. Very hard to differentiate yourself.
What, as I was thinking about this, because you know the topic here is reasons why localization. I don't want to go off on too many tangents here. Reasons why localization companies are bought and sold. And I'm wondering, have you ever had any, because I know you're talking to everybody, right? You are out there talking to everybody. And have you ever talked to somebody who perhaps wasn't ready to buy right away? And after talking to them for a little while, they came around, maybe they called you a month later, 6 months later, and said, you know what, I've been thinking about it, and I think it's time. This isn't, for those of you listening out there, this isn't like, we did not discuss these questions beforehand. So, like, if he has a really good answer for this, then it's not.
Well, because let's separate buyers and the sellers a little bit, Tucker.
Yeah, okay.
I often talk to people who aren't ready to buy for a bunch of different reasons. We mentioned a few, but there's all sorts of different reasons on why. And I would say the largest two, is that either they're not quite ready to move on in life, or they don't feel their company is at the value level they want it to be at to sell. So that's super common. And absolutely, I'll talk to them. We'll go through the numbers. We'll understand the opportunities. We'll talk about potential buyers. And they absolutely come back later when they feel either they're more valuable, or they feel that they do want to move on in life and get to somewhere else, or it is time for retirement, or the fact that they don't think they can grow and they want to become part of another org. And I think that's super important to understand. It's not always about just selling your company. A lot of the times it's about selling the company to become part of a different organization, to be able to go and do the things that you want to do with more resources, be able to take a product that you developed and sold to 100 people, but now sell it to 1,000 people. And so when we look at these acquisitions, we talk about these things separately, like are they buying customers, are they buying technology, are they buying people? But the best acquisitions are when they want all three. And all three go into a new organization and become a division of that organization, or become a cornerstone, a new cornerstone of that organization, or a new vertical speciality that's happening in that organization. And that the seller, while he does get some money and some value for what he's done, does have a job going into the future and is super excited. Maybe they took some of the price in stock in the new organization. So as I said, every deal is going to be different, but we do see a lot of situations, and these are the ones that I enjoy the most, where there's a place for everybody to go and something for everybody to do, and where you're really trying to make 1 + 1 = 3.
I think a big part of what you do, is like, it's kind of a joke, but it's like you take all of these different skill sets. Part of it is like just knowledge of markets and knowledge of the business, or knowledge of markets, right? And the other is knowledge of how business and operations work, financial statements and that. But an often underlooked one, or overlooked skill, that I think is super important to your job is essentially that of, I don't want to say babysitter, because that's like, that's offensive to our clients, and it's not that. It's
we have a word for it.
What is the word for it?
It's growth consulting.
Growth
I mean, in the
consulting. Okay,
process of
yeah.
selling your company, you get the benefits of whoever you're working with should be bringing a lot to the table, a lot more than just having a transaction. I mean, that's how I look at it, at least. So I know the people that I've worked with, we almost go through a small re-engineering of their company to make it ready for sale, to make it more valuable. I always look at how you present yourself. I'm putting the sellers on the hot seat of presenting their company to different kinds of buyers. So you need a different story for each one. So we do a lot of growth consulting, and NIMSY is about growth consulting. Renato and the team and Joseph and his team are always working on helping you grow your sales and your sales process and all that. I'm looking at your company a little bit differently, but it's all about growth consulting. And, you know, I think NIMSY does a great job at that, and it's fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
I know there's been several.
And not a joke.
yeah. I know there's been several opportunities that you've actually chucked over to the research, the consult Inga and her team, or Joseph, just because they weren't ready to sell yet, but they were ready to sell maybe 3 years from now, 5 years from now. And there's certain things that they needed to do in order to get ready to sell. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that, you know, not to take over the conversation, but because you're the expert, but one of the biggest mistakes I see people make, whether it's a decision to sell their company, buy another company, whether it's a decision to apply for a job. I mean, let's take it down to a more micro level. But it's just this analysis paralysis and like fear of the unknown. And what happens is... you end up procrastinating it. And then when you actually do have the guts to go do it, you realize, oh, I should have started this 3 years ago. And I have several things like that going on with me right now.
Yep. So it's funny. I mean, people need to realize that selling your company isn't an overnight thing. Even when we find, even when we hook up with a good buyer in a short amount of time, let's say we go to market and within a month we have someone who's super interested, it still might take 6 or 8 months to close a deal. And during that 6 or 8 months, you know, you need to keep your company operating. The new buyer's expecting things to keep tracking the way they have been tracking. So, you know, I spend a lot of time making sure a lot of that's happening too, that, you know, but you know, we're selling real entities. We're selling things that are alive. Companies are alive and operating. They have a heartbeat. And, you know, as a broker, it's my job to make sure that's super strong and continuing. And it's important to the buyer too. The buyers are buying the future. They're not buying the past. And this is probably one of the bigger issues in syncing people up, because sellers want to be valued on what they did. You know, we did all this business, we had all these customers, so I'm worth this. And buyers are like, yeah, that's true, but I need you to go here. I need it to do this to pay for the money I'm spending. And so that syncing up that idea, making sure that people on both sides understand that, is super important and important to the success. So sellers need to understand that the performance going forward, you know, is what the buyers are really buying. So making sure that that's all top notch and packaged up, you know, wrapped up with a bow tie on top, you know, is important. But not just that it's all looking pretty when it goes, but that it's really going to still hum and move and grow going forward.
I like that. For those that didn't catch that, I'll just repeat it, which is buyers are looking at the future. They're not looking at past. People don't care about past performance other than insofar that it will be a predictor of future performance. So it doesn't matter how great you are. Doesn't matter how great you've been, how great are you going to be is something they look at. I don't know if you can see these slides, J.O., but I brought up the second slide here, which is what localization company owners need for mergers and acquisitions. And, of course, we have the first blatant, shameless plug for J.O.'s services here, which is work with a broker. But without getting too shameless, well, you know what? There's no shame in being shameless is what I say. To a certain degree. Tell us a little bit about why? Like, in a sentence or two, like, why should people work with a broker? Because I know there's, I've talked to people that are out there, company owners, and say, oh, yes, you know, my friend and I have been talking, or I'm thinking of selling to this company, like a direct deal. When does it make sense to do that? And because I don't want to say like, oh, fear, uncertainty, doubt, like always work with a broker, hire JO now, because sometimes it might make sense to do that.
Yep. I think that, I think for a seller, it's very important to have a broker. I use the real estate industry, you know, for example, you know, you would, if you want to sell your house, you don't have to have a real estate broker. You could sell it to the guy across the street from you and have the papers drawn up and, you know, might be a little bit of work, things you've never done before, but you can absolutely do it. There's nothing blocking you. And the same is true as selling a company. You know, my job is to package you up, get you the most value, get people to the door, bring you to people that you might not have been thinking about. You know, I'm the matchmaker on the front side. Once a match is made, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done. Going through due diligence is a big process, especially if you're bigger companies. And, you know, timing and speed are of the essence. And so, you know, I'm there to make sure, a broker's there to make sure things are happening quickly and fast and on schedule. Because when you go into due diligence, you start to spend money. Both the seller is going to start to spend money, and the buyer is starting to spend big money. And, you know, no one wants to waste that money. And so, you know, I'm still, the broker is still kind of the ringleader, making sure everybody is getting to the finish line. There's a lot of things that brokers don't do. You know, we're not lawyers, we're not accountants, we're not tax advisors, you know, we're not compliance officers, and things like that. So, you know, you have to understand, you know, what a broker does versus what others do and where they all fit. But be it as it may, my involvement sometimes goes up to a certain point and then the lawyers take over. It's gone all the way to the end and scheduled final payments. You know, it really depends on each individual deal. I would absolutely tell any seller that you've got to have a broker. Doesn't need to be me. I think I do a good job, but have one, even if it isn't me. And on the buyer side, it gets interesting. The smaller deals, you won't find the buyers having their own brokers. Sometimes you do see buyers with their own brokers as well. But usually buyers will have, who are doing lots of acquisitions, will have a team, an internal team, and they'll have their external auditors and accountants and lawyers all up and ready to go. And all the more reason why the seller needs a broker, just to keep up with all those people.
It's a lot of cat herding. Mm-hmm. To do.
It is. And, you know, time is the enemy in some respects. A lot of deals just kind of flitter away because they didn't happen when they should have, and some other priority showed up or some other opportunity showed up for the buyer. Yeah. So from a seller's perspective, time is of the essence. If somebody is interested in you, you know, it's really important that we make sure that we take advantage of that, because it can go away very, very easily.
It happens
a lot.
What's the shortest amount of time and the longest amount of time you've seen a deal close in?
Oh, I would say the shortest amount of time is 4 to 5 months, maybe 6 months is a short deal. A long deal is a year. We did a deal that took over a year. I mean, the pandemic got in the way. Yeah. But I've had a deal take that long. It wasn't solid work for that entire year.
Sure.
A lot of consternation in the conclusion of it has been great for everybody, but they can take a long time.
Right.
And the smaller the companies, the quicker it's going to go. That's the other thing, that there's due diligence required. There's less fear. The numbers are smaller, so they're less critical. Also, if the buyer and the seller have a pretty solid agreement and what the deal is going to look like, it can go a lot faster as well.
Nice.
So we've learned a lot about, you know, the importance of the LOI in the process, and that the LOI represents, you know, as close to what the final deal is going to look like as possible.
Very nice. gonna pull up our chat here because we've got some chat activity.
All right.
See if there's any questions from folks here. Bear with me. All right, in no particular order. Jordan Evans, hello, sir. Thank you for joining us. Yes, Jonathan, having done two acquisitions, having the entire team, clients, tools, and goodwill were so important. Thank you, Jordan. Inga Bonin, I gave you a shout out earlier. Buyers buy for the future. People don't care about the past. Just reiterating what we said. It only matters as so far as it predicts how the future will look. Thank you, Inga, for joining. And E.T., how are you? E.T. is going to be joining us, I believe, on a Monday morning live stream on Clubhouse. And I can't remember when that's going to be, if it's this upcoming Monday or 2 weeks from now. But make sure to check that out. If you're on Clubhouse, go follow E.T. and you'll know where to find her. Inga Boonen, so true. It's how your capabilities can fit in the context of growth and support. Nice. Mariano Sanz, hello. What do you think that stopped, I want to say HIG from purchasing TransPerfect, as this was going to be such a big op? Ooh, that's a JO question. It's not.
I have no idea. I mean, I didn't know that was one of the ones on the table. I heard there were some more big deals coming after we saw RWS and SDL and Accolade and Amplexor. I've heard of other large ones. HIG's the firm that controls Linebridge. Linebridge and TransPerfect going together. I guess that's what you're forecasting. That would be pretty interesting. Certainly lots of overlap on services offered and other things, but big deals like that have to be perfect. And, you know, there's when the money comes from a PE firm versus coming from the stock market or other areas, it's always going to be different. So I can't tell you any specific reasons why things don't happen, but there's many, many different things that can get in the way of a good deal or that have to be lined up perfectly for something to happen.
Jordan Evans, how about the complexity of deal structures, Jonathan? What are some common or recurring deal structures you see? This is from Jordan Evans, once again.
So, important to realize, especially for what I'll call the average deal, it's, you know, payment is really made in two pieces. Normally there's a cash payment and there's some sort of earnout or payout. In my mind, I separate the two, an earnout being something that you're paid based on something that's going to happen in the future. We'll give you, you know, a certain amount of money if the revenue exceeds this certain level. That's what we call an earnout. And a payout is simply when the amount of money that's being paid doesn't vary, but it's being paid out over time. And I call that a payout. And I like to separate them because the basis, of course, is very different. One is kind of a financing tool, and the other one is really a futures tool. One is that the price is already set. The payout that you're going to get is already set, so your cash amount and your payout are fixed. That's not going to change over time, or an earnout has the potential to actually change over time and used to really go for the seller. It's used to be able to make more money than the original deal was valued at, and for the buyer, it's a little bit of protection, because if all of a sudden the future isn't quite as good as the expectation was, they don't have to pay as much. Averages really don't exist. I want to use the word average, and so I apologize that I use it too much, but you most often will see cash portion being 50% of the deal, and the rest of the remuneration being a payout earnout. That 50% can vary to as low as 30 and as high as 70. And that really just depends on who's buying you, how they look at your value, how much they're willing to pay up front versus in the future. But I think the most important thing to take out of it is very few deals are 100% cash. If it is 100% cash, it's usually at a much lower multiple. Because you're getting all your cash up front, you're removing the risk, and people are going to pay less money if you're removing your risk but increasing their risk.
Very good. Let's see what else we got here.
It's a long-winded answer. I apologize.
That, no, that's great. That's great. E.T. Hey, Tucker, thanks for the shout-out. Yes, shout-out for E.T. Another one. Mariano says, yes, fair enough answer. See, we'll admit when we don't know. Oops, I hit the wrong button, but that's okay. We'll give...
Mariano must know a few things. Some of us don't, which is great.
Yeah, yeah.
Share.
You know, one thing that's great about NIMSI is, you know, is we don't have to know... Like, I don't have to know everything. J.O. doesn't have to know everything. We have a very active Slack channel. Well, it's Google Chats. I just call it Slack because everyone knows what Slack is. Where, you know, hey, I got a question from our client. Who is a MemSource expert? Well, we are... But it's cool. So what I'm trying to say is if we don't know the answer to something, we will let you know. We will say we don't know. But I want to move on. J.O., and I want to be respectful of your time, J.O., because this is a pop-up event. This is not planned. Did you have a meeting that we need to get to? It is now 11 o'clock.
I have a few more minutes.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about natural partners versus unnatural partners. You mentioned in the video that we started this stream with, you said one of my jobs is to introduce people to the natural partners and to introduce them to some unnatural partners. Talk about that a little bit.
So somebody in the language services space, a natural partner would be another company in the language services space, someone offering similar services or someone who wants to expand their offerings, but their basic job is selling language services to customers. But we see a lot of technology companies, or I would say service providers, who've gone global. I'll give you, for instance, a company like Canva. Canva has a platform of building websites, and they've made that super, super easy for people. And they've expanded that platform to be able to do that in different languages for different people in different countries. But they've also done it so that they can take somebody can take their product and build it in English, and then Canva will translate it into other languages for them. Canva's business is not being a language service provider. They just need this underneath the covers and as a product feature of their particular product. Well, an LSP or a technology LSP might have something that is attractive to a company like that. Not someone who's going to sell it for what it is, but someone who's going to use it under the covers or behind the scenes or as a service within a service. And so I call those unnatural buyers. And so there's a tremendous number of companies that are gaining huge traction with their products, that are going global, that need translation within their product. Think about all the CRM guys. Think about all the customer support guys. Think about all the language services that are inside of Salesforce or inside of ServiceNow. So it goes on and on and on. And so a lot of a broker's job is making sure that if there's going to be more value to one of those people, that we figure that out. So that's an unnatural buyer. I also think it's unnatural to easily sell to one of the big guys, Facebook, like, Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon. Yeah, yeah. The industry calls them FAGMA. I actually pass most of my
FAGMA
deals. The industry calls that FAGMA. There's a term out there that you'll see every once in a while.
That sounds like a problematic term, but I'm assuming it stands for Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon again, because Amazon is that important.
Apple in there. Okay. And so I actually have contacts in all of those. And, you know, if I feel that the deal, you know, if they need to see that deal, they will. And we've had discussions and presentations to them in the past. So, you know, those are, to me, I'll say that's an unnatural buyer because, you know, for a lot of reasons. And selling to them is super difficult and shouldn't be expected. But they still are interested, and they're always looking, and they can be great buyers.
Yeah, I was about to say, you know, selling anything to them can be super difficult, let alone trying to sell an entire company.
I think the easiest way to say is that you cannot sell anything to any of those.
Nope.
But if they decide they want to own something, if they decide they want to buy you, we can get a deal out of it.
If they decide they want what you have, then you can facilitate them taking it from you.
Correct.
And hopefully make some money.
A little bit of what I do is actually been working with people on how to get positioned and get noticed by them. Because as I said, you can't just knock on the door and say, here's somebody for sale. You need to look at this. They won't even stop to look at it many times. But if they run into you in the marketplace, if their customers start telling them you need to do this, or if their customers say, I need this working within your environment, or I need this on Azure, or this at AWS, or this link, you know, that makes them stop and look. And so I do spend a fair amount of time, you know, looking at products and how they're presented and you know, connecting those dots to make that better.
Yeah, it's a really good point. You know, selling a company, selling an LSP is, you know, sales principles, sales best practices apply. Like, don't just cold call clients and ask them to buy something from you. You know, work on your brand perception, work on your brand presence, all of these different things. The idea is, you know, if you're selling a company, you don't want to be calling people and saying, hey, do you want to sell this company? It's called blah, blah, blah. Who? I've never heard of them before, right? You want to be calling them, hey, I'm representing blah, blah, blah. And they say, oh, blah, 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 right? Like, that's what you want to get. But I think that's often forgotten, not just for LSP owners, buyers, but for salespeople as well.
And I think the buyers I want to say this wrong. The buyers have a lot of brokers like me calling on them and other people calling on them to buy stuff. So they're getting teasers all the time. But
teaser for our audience. What's a teaser?
A teaser is a document that describes a purchase opportunity, describes a company that's for sale without identifying who it really is. So it teases you. And if you get teased enough, you'll sign an NDA and you'll be able to learn the name of the company. And that's a common process that buying and selling goes through.
So it's a way to shop. I just want to, for the people that are watching, the teaser is a way to shop around a company and generate interest, but it's anonymized. It's not putting your reputation out there. It's essentially the first step. It's like casting your line out, baiting your hook and casting your line. And then when you get a bite, that's when you set the hook, and that's when you put the NDAs in place and due diligence, exclusivity, blah.
The anonymity that you mentioned, I want people to realize is super important. This isn't a big public process, and it shouldn't be. I spend a lot of time making sure that what I'm doing with people is private. Even people at NIMSY, you know, it's not a common conversation. You know, who's for sale, even within NIMSY.
And I can vouch for that because I'm the guy like putting all of the lockdowns on the CRM, and I'm the one making the private spaces for Joe. So yeah, it's a serious matter.
It is, and I'm pretty anal about that. And Tucker, some days Tucker's gotten my wrath. But it's super important. And so, you know, the deals go out anonymous. People don't know you're for sale. People sign NDAs to find out. The industry is pretty good about being quiet about that. But that's a big part of the process. But I just wanted to get back to what I wanted to say a few minutes ago. Buyers have a lot of people sending them companies, and they don't have to work real hard to find stuff because it all comes to their desk in the form of a teaser or phone calls or whatever. But I think it's super important for buyers to make sure people like me know what they really want. So I try to get conversations going with the buyers all the time. I try to at least once a year, if not two or three times a year, have an update from them on what they're looking for. Because a lot of times it's not about what I have for sale, but what I know might become available, or maybe it's me as a broker's job to find people and tell them it's time to be sold. So one of our best deals was where we listened to a buyer and went and found a company and sold it to them. And, you know, it was a fantastic deal, a huge multiple. And the sellers were absolutely not interested in selling or thinking they should. But it ended up being a great thing for them and the right thing at the right time. And, you know, that's the other matchmaking part that we that we do. So, you know, I've spent a lot of time talking to some of the bigger companies recently, and I'm off in Asia looking for things for them specifically. And I just think, you know, we call that, you know, the buy side, and buy side services, sometimes they're paid for, sometimes they're not. But the buy side communications, I think, can be better than it is and should be better than it is. And so I work hard to try to make sure that happens too. It's not just about talking to sellers, but the buyers are super important.
Yeah, what does that mean? The buy side communication should be better.
I think the buyers should be telling people like me and brokers like me, you know, more and more about what they need on a consistent basis.
Yeah, that's the classic salesman's gripe, right? The clients should communicate better. But I mean, it would help, though. It would help, because knowing, and that's why, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out what those clients want, right? Because the onus is upon us. No, the onus is upon the person wanting to sell their company, right? And when they eventually get sick of that and trying to figure out what the buyers want, I think that's when they call J.O. But you made a really good point about, you know, just building relationships with the people. And I think one of the themes that is I've seen crop back up here today is, you know, keep your wicks trimmed. Sorry to use a biblical reference, but always be ready. Like, be ready. And if you don't know what that means, to be ready, you know, Renato, our colleague Renato, says, you know, his morning prayers, the morning prayers for an LSP owner should be to wake up and you ask yourself three questions. Here we go. Let's see if I can remember them. What am I going to do today to buy another company? Or grow my current company, what am I going to do today to buy another company, and what am I going to do today to sell my company? Every morning you wake up and you ask those three things, because an opportunity might come. Like, you might have, you might meet a cousin, a long lost cousin with deep pockets and a ton of money that really wants to buy an LSP, but oh, you're not ready because you didn't know what you needed to do to get ready. You know, simple things like, you know, have some clean books, you know, hire an accountant, hire a bookkeeper. Things like, you know, oh, I should have, instead of investing millions of dollars into proprietary technology, I should have invested that into brand marketing. You know, these little things. I'm making up stuff.
This is that time of year. It's tax time. So yeah. Everybody's looking at their numbers right now already. So it's a good time to be, you know, asking those questions and, you know, do a value check with somebody like me.
Yep. So that's our plug. Talk to us. J.O., let's go back and see if there's any questions, comments. I don't want to be doing this all day, but let's see here. Giovanna, Jordan Evans, fantastic answer, Jonathan. I have no idea what he was referring to because that was from a while ago. But good job, Jonathan. Giovanna, what does she say? Huh. I have done that to help. God, I need to change this. If anybody knows how to update CSS, you know, cascading style sheets in OBS, running from a browser source, please comment below, and I want to pay you to help me. Giovanna Lester, huh, I have done that to help friends in the end. All right, Giovanna, I'm just going to, can I help two strangers trust each other and find a common interest? Yeah, no, I did not get anything for it, but they did well. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, talking back to our previous conversation. But
yep.
You know, it's one of the great things about this industry is that we help each other. We legit help each other, and I think that's cool. So, J.O., if there's no comments, any closing words from you before I ask everybody to subscribe again?
Appreciate the time you've given me, Tucker. Look forward to meeting more and more people in this industry. And, you know, if anybody has any questions or wants to reach out, you can find me on the NIMSE site and schedule a half hour.
Yeah. Consultations are free, guys. There's no barrier here. If you're interested in finding out more, arm yourself with knowledge. Knowledge is power. And we're not the only game in town. Check it. Talk to the other guys. Talk to everybody. And I mean that. I definitely mean that. Just like if you were buying a house, I would recommend that you talk to many different people. If you've liked this pop-up event, the thing about pop-up events is if you don't subscribe above, below, you're not going to get notified of them because we're not announcing these. We're doing things differently here at NIMSY. We're getting away from the webinar format. We're going to live. We're going to pop-up. If you would like to be a host, hey, I can get J.O. on here. I can get you on here, right? You got an interesting story to tell. You got something interesting to talk about. Let's do a pop-up event. The only caveat is we're doing it tomorrow because I don't want to give you guys time to prepare. I don't prepare for these. You shouldn't get to either. NIMSY Insights is a market research and consulting company. We focus primarily on the language services industry, but are expanding very, very quickly into pretty much any companies that want to go global. We do consulting, market research, language,
culture,
technology.
Culture.
Culturalization. Oh, I'm a horrible salesperson. We do a bunch of stuff and my sizzle reel ran out, so I'm out of time.
Growth consulting. That's what we're here for.
Growth all consulting, time. In a word. So with that, thank you very much for all of the people that joined us in the chat today. We'll see you next time. Ciao.
Peace, everybody. Take care.